case for argument this morning is Del Monte Fresh Produce against Transportation Insurance Company. Mr. Gauntlet.
If it pleases the court, David Gauntlet for Del Monte.
Samples?
I'm sorry?
You brought samples? How do you expect to get anywhere in this case without...
Yeah, I was expecting a pineapple to be sitting right next
to you.
Actually,
you're all possible claimants in the underlying suit if you've ever bought Del Monte Gold Pineapple, which apparently is sold at Trader Joe's. Your Honor, I think this case is very simple. The district court applied the wrong test and looked at the wrong facts in looking at the knowledge of falsity exclusion. This case is very similar to the Cincinnati Insurance v. Eastern Atlantic case from this court. And in that case, there were two policies, one a primary policy and another an umbrella policy. The umbrella policy, in addition to a knowledge of falsity exclusion, had an intentional acts exclusion. That made a difference in the result there. Perhaps if all we had was the alleged misuse of patent, it could make a difference here, except we don't have that different policy language. The court assumed that any act that was not negligent was outside the coverage of the policy under the exclusion in the policy. That's simply not true.
But let me ask you this question, Mr. Gauntlet. When an insurance company has a case proffered to it and it's deciding whether it has a duty to defend, what it's supposed to do is look at the allegations in the complaint, right, and compare it to the policy. And I would like you to direct me to one or two places in this group of complaints where you think an allegation in the complaint is made, you know, not just a phrase, but a real allegation in a complaint is made that should have triggered a duty to defend.
Well, let's go to paragraph 28A of the Williams decision, or Williams complaint. It says, Del Monte sent threatening letters to others in the trade which stated that some of Dole's pineapple materials had been stolen, that the recipients of letters might be in possession of some of the stolen materials. Accusing someone of being a thief is defamation, as the NVIDIA court by Judge Phillip found in 2005.
But Vasilitos. Are the same people the plaintiffs?
Well, that's the second issue, Your Honor. And the question is, do they have to be the plaintiffs?
Knoll Pharmaceuticals.
Let's start with my actual question. Are they the plaintiffs? Is anyone who was defamed a plaintiff in this litigation?
That is, no, they were not, Your Honor.
Right.
The only people who were defamed.
Now we can go to the next question.
Right. Okay, so the people who were defamed are folks like Dole and other folks that were in the pineapple business.
They, I gather, have settled.
That case settled, Your Honor. So this case is the follow-up case by the purchasers who are direct and indirect purchasers of pineapples. There's only two decisions,
I
both from Illinois.
I hope there are suits by indirect purchasers of pineapples.
We have some state law.
there's distributors as well as ultimate purchasers who are in the chain. There's an old pharmaceutical decision.
Well, we don't have an Illinois brick problem to decide today.
No, you don't have to go there. I thought you had some state laws.
So anyway, the question is, does it matter under the policy language that you have a party suing where the disparagement is not directly of that party but another party, and consequences flow from that disparagement which impact adversely the party such that they're seeking relief? And that issue has been addressed with specificity in Illinois by Judge Castillo in the Knoll Pharmaceutical case, and subsequently reaching the same favorable result by Judge Deragian in a case that was published after briefing.
Are there any decisions of Illinois courts that you're relying on?
There's only those two cases addressing it in Illinois, Your Honor.
I think decisions of federal district judges.
I understand.
On questions of state law. And $1.50 will get you a cup of coffee.
Right. Well, it's just not an issue that's come up that far, Your Honor. But the other case, just to reference it, is the BAS case at 2006 WL1235943. The argument is quite simple. It says both cases note that oral or written publication material that slanders or libels a organization or disparages a organization suffices. It doesn't say it has to be the party suing. In effect, they want to rewrite the policy to have it say something it doesn't. There's no provision in those policies that limit coverage in the action in which the insured has to sue directly.
What's troubling is that you've taken this allegation in this Williams complaint, and I think there are others similar.
Yes.
But that is part of the background that those plaintiffs are building up as part of their monopolization claim, their ultimate Section 2 claim. They aren't seeking damages because of the disparagement. This is a standard overcharge case, as I understand it.
Right, but you're looking at how liability may attach, and under these policies, you have to look at what the offense is, not the injury or damage.
Well, the offense is a Sherman Act offense or a state equivalent state unfair competition offense, but these consumers, you're not saying that there's a duty to defend every time a fact needs to be proved to get to liability, are you?
Actually, I am, and that's the way the law works in this area, and there's five cases that say so. If you look at the Lamb decision by Judge Krauske, it points out that under these policies, a triggering event is the wrongful act, not the resulting injury to the claimant. So forget about the theory of liability.
That doesn't prove what I just said, though. You know, if you have to prove that something happened at 9 o'clock in the morning, that doesn't mean that liability turns on...
No, but you could have liability for the act of arguing that these folks are thieves, and that could occur where there was no proof of any patent misuse or any other liability
being asserted. But the consumers are worried that they're paying too much for the pineapples.
Yes, but why is it that they're paying too much?
The reason they're complaining about the disparagement is because other providers of pineapples, like Dole or Maui or whoever, aren't there in the market offering more pineapples for sale, thus increasing the supply and bringing the price down.
Yeah, but you're forgetting about the interference counts, which are based on underlying acts of defamation and disparagement. And five courts, two decisions by this court, look to those kind of counts. An interference count looks to underlying tortious conduct, defamation or disparagement. And then the question is that underlying defamation or disparagement actionable? Nolan Graphics.
What do you mean? Which interference count are you talking about?
All of these allegations are part of the interference with prospective economic advantage count that are part of the underlying claimant suit. In addition to these
three. Consumers are bringing suits for economic advantage?
They are asserting such claims, yes, as part of the deceptive. They have unfair competition counts, and they're saying that they were injured as a consequence of these interfering acts. They don't have to. So you go back then to the question of, do they have to be the actual plaintiff in a suit, say for defamation directly? And the answer is they don't, because the policy language doesn't require that. It's not an incidental piece of evidence. It's key to why the pineapples cost more money, and they cost more money because there was no competitor on market in the same period of time. Now, the other thing to bear in mind is I have a completely different theory on misappropriation of advertising ideas, where they are directly injured by the statements that create misappropriation of advertising ideas. So even if you...
What advertising idea did Del Monte
That they were unique,
steal?
That they were the only extra sweet pineapple on the marketplace, which was
that's
a true statement.
I don't see how that's either an advertising idea or something that can be misappropriated. It is the theme of almost every advertising campaign since the dawn of man.
Well, what they're saying is that they were the only supplier of a particular kind of their source was the only supplier of a particular kind of product. It's no different than saying these goods are Indian made, or that a particular kind of cattle is full blood, or that something that's mixed canola and olive oil is in fact pure olive oil. They're saying that we have the legitimate source of extra sweet pineapple. It's a claim of authenticity, and that claim of authenticity is allegedly not true, is allegedly part of the liability that was urged by the claimants, and that basis for liability is true.
Allegedly, Del Monte knew perfectly well that it wasn't true,
and
the plaintiffs can't win if they don't show that.
No, that's not true. It was true that we were the only pineapple on market during the policy period that had that unique characteristics.
Well,
the reason that was true is...
How can the plaintiffs prevail if Del Monte did not subjectively know that it was lying?
Take
the Walker process theory, the fraud on the patent office. It's an intentional deceit theory.
Yes.
And these others are intentional deceit theories or nothing, one would think.
Well, it doesn't matter if it's an intentional deceit theory if you don't have an exclusion for intentional acts.
An exclusion for intentional torts.
There's no exclusion for intentional torts in this policy. I ask you to find it for me. It's not here. Look at Eastern Atlantic. You'll see there is a kind of policy that has one. This is not that policy. There's an exclusion for knowing false statements. It's not a knowing false statement to say that pineapple is unique.
One normally means by an intentional.
Well, actually, when you say that you do not intend harm, that is different than saying that you know something is false. The knowledge of falsity exclusion applies when that which is the basis for the disparagement is known to be false under the disparagement prong or the misappropriation prong, that the unique aspect, that statement is false. I'd like to reserve a little time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Bolson.
May it please the court. Although Mr. Gauntlet says that the case is very simple, that sounded like a very complicated, convoluted argument to me. Our position is that the case is, at least conceptually, simple. You compare the allegations of the underlying complaints with the policy wording. And the policy wording precludes coverage for injury arising out of oral or written publication of material if done by or at the direction of the insured with knowledge of its falsity. Here, the complaints allege solely and exclusively injury arising out of Del Monte's oral or written statements made with knowledge of their falsity, and these fall within three broad categories.
Mr. Balsam, could I ask you, if the people who had filed these complaints had taken fuller advantage of Rule 8 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure and had simply alleged various underlying facts enough to give Del Monte notice of a claim such that they could prove either an intentional act or carelessness or what have you, you would have had to defend that case, right? In other words, if the complaint had been drafted more broadly.
If it had been drafted more broadly, we might have had to. But
the complaint in fact chose to draft seemed to have intentional misstatement at their heart.
It has only intentional misstatements at their heart, and as the Connecticut indemnity case says, you take the complaint as it's drafted, not some hypothetical version of what might have been drafted or could have been drafted. So this complaint just alleges fraudulent patent applications where Del Monte knew that it wasn't entitled to a patent. It alleges intentionally false and misleading letters to its competitors, trying to dupe them into thinking that Del Monte had patent rights that Del Monte knew it didn't have. And it involves sham patent litigation, asserting patent rights that Del Monte didn't know existed. All the allegations fall within those three broad categories. And all of this is alleged to be part of a scheme to eliminate competition, an intentional scheme, all done purposefully to prevent its competitors from growing and selling this particular kind of pineapple. The complaints are absolutely barren of any allegation of accident, inadvertence, negligence, error, mistake. And in this instance, we would look to that Connecticut indemnity case as providing at least the guiding principles for resolving this case here. In that case, as the court might recall, that involved a travel agency that was alleged to have collected VAT taxes not only on the foreign car rentals, but on its own booking fees. And there was this intentional scheme alleged, and the district court held that there was a duty to defend, and this court reversed, holding that the complaint is barren of any mention of negligence, mistake, inadvertence, or error. And it was only the complaint only said that the insured deceived, schemed, and defrauded its customers, and that's exactly what we have here. Now,
what about Mr. Gauntlet's insistence that there's no general intentional tort exclusion in this policy? The policy doesn't actually ever say, at least as far as I saw, intentional torts are all excluded. It talks instead about misleading language and the like,
right.
False.
Right. I think that in the context of this particular policy, which deals with advertising injury, it functionally it's a very similar thing. This part of the policy does not deal with bodily injury. It just deals with injuries that come from defamation or disparagement. And so I think you're kind of getting at the same thing. All of the
I just want to make sure I understand your argument. The knowledge of falsity language in the policy, in this section of the policy, covers what the intentional tort would be in this area, I guess.
I think it's not entirely clear, but you know, I would prefer to just look at the actual wording of the policy and the wording of the complaint, because you know what it's compared to, it's I don't know all of the wrinkles, but the exclusion itself is pretty clear that it just deals with false statements knowingly made, and that's what we have here. Now, Judge Wood, you asked Mr. Gauntlet to point out some allegations involving something less than knowing statements, and he pointed out this Williams allegation. It's at page 365 of their appendix. And, I mean, if you just look at that, first of all, it's an allegation about Dole saying that Del Monte sent letters saying that Dole's pineapples were stolen. I mean, this is just not what anyone is seeking liability for. And moreover, it's within the very paragraph, it's stated that this accusation was made in an attempt to maintain an unlawful monopoly, and that in furtherance of this monopoly, Dole contended, you know, this statement, and that Del Monte was implying that it had patented this pineapple. So even this allegation, you know, of all these complaints here, this is the one thing that they can point to or try to point to that deals with something less than knowing false statements. And even this is saturated with allegations of some knowing improper conduct.
They talk a lot in their briefs about the theft of the seeds, the alleged theft.
I think that's what I think that's what this is. And I, frankly, Your Honor, I couldn't get my head around it exactly how that related to any of the issues here. It seems
I thought they were saying more or less how we thought the seeds really were stolen, so if we were accusing somebody of that, we weren't being misleading, and yet it might be actionable. I don't know.
Right, but that doesn't. I mean, you have to read the cases are clear that you have to read these complaints as a whole, and Del Monte is not trying to be held liable for that particular letter or that one accusation. This is an intentional scheme to monopolize the pineapple business. That is what's been alleged here, and you have to, although you do give the plaintiff the benefit of the doubt, or the insured the benefit of the doubt, you still must read the complaints as a whole. And, I mean, the whole point of insurance is to guard against or to protect against fortuitous events. And where the insured, we would submit, makes knowingly false and harmful statements against others in an effort to hurt their business and suppress competition, and these others then turn around and sue the insured, this is just not the type of case where they should be able to look to their liability insurer to bail them out. That's not what insurance is for. There are no accidents alleged here. No fortuitous events, only a knowing, fraudulent scheme to eliminate competition and improperly propagate and maintain a monopoly. And that's just, you know, the exclusion is in there because that's not the purpose of liability insurance.
Or at least you're saying that's not the policy your client thought it was selling.
Right. Precisely. Precisely.
Maybe a different point. Yeah.
If there are any, that's all I prepared to say. If there's any further questions. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Gauntlet?
Yes.
Judge Witt got it right. That's what we're saying. We're saying that the district court didn't look at the question of when we are alleged to have been sued for interference by claiming that they stole our proprietary seeds. That statement, which creates defamation exposure, is that statement false? It's not. We deny that it is, in fact, false. It is, in fact, true. And so we could, but we have to defend against the claim that it's false. If we lose on that, we could be held liable for nothing else. Monopolization based on telling people you should stay off market because the seeds you're using to propagate your pineapples are stolen. We could have indemnity thereby be larger than defense. You've got to look at Cincinnati, the Eastern Atlantic, very carefully and note the difference in language between the two policies, the primary and the umbrella. We have the primary policy. Deliberate activity, intentional activity, still duty to defend. Why? No knowledge of falsity. The statements were not false at the time they were made. Three other district court decisions agree in an interference context, as does the earlier decision applying Wisconsin law, the Curtis Universal decision, where the court expressly addressed the knowledge of falsity exclusion, found it inapplicable in an antitrust context where there were discrete factual statements based on liability for disparagement and defamation, that those statements themselves were not false. So when you reread the briefs, which I urge you to do, please look at the statement on pineapple seed theft and see if that doesn't lead you to the correct result, that in that part of the case, a defense is compelled because it creates liability, potential liability that is within the scope of the coverage.
Not any trust liability, you aren't saying.
No, there's an interference count based on disparagement that is part of this lawsuit. They want to talk about the antitrust case. This is not about the antitrust counts. It's about distinct counts for interference, which are based on conduct that is allegedly false, which we contend is not false, which statements were not made with falsity, and which statements had an injurious impact for the reasons noted in the Knoll Pharmaceutical case and the BASF case. And on the alternative, if you have a problem with the character of the injury, look at the fact that when you state that you have the only extra sweet pineapple on the marketplace and you're the unique source of that, that's an advertising idea. It's an idea for that product, very similar to claiming pure olive oil. And when that statement is in fact true, because we were the only one on market during the policy period, that again creates potential coverage outside the knowledge of falsity. Only that's a direct claim, so you don't have to deal with the question of the indirect claim that you had a question about. And I think that's really all that you need to look at. Fortuity is a different doctrine. It has no application here, whereas of the date the policies incepted, there was no knowledge that they had, that people at Del Monte had, that the theft allegations were improper in any way, because we truly believed and still believe and have filed an answer in the underlying case that there was, in fact, such theft. And so this is a case where you have to look that the potential for coverage, looking at the specific facts that create coverage as opposed to broad brush theories. Context is not a substitution to add limiting policy language that's not in the policy that the carriers would have preferred to have written into it. They would have preferred to have written the umbrella policy in the Eastern Atlantic case, according to their arguments here. They didn't. They shouldn't be given the same benefit. The DER case is extremely distinguishable because that case involved an Arizona emissions policy where negligent acts had to occur in order to trigger coverage in the primary policy. Not true here. And if you look at the cases that we cite, especially in the reply brief, you see there's a plethora of decisions that make the point that these particular kind of policies cover intentional acts. Thank you very much.
Taken under advisement.